Welcome to this special follow-up interview program based on a CME symposium held in Chicago in June during the annual ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this conference, we took a meet the professors type approach and focused on two major issues, multiple myeloma and lymphomas in CLL. For this interview program, I met with one faculty person from each of these major topics and reviewed the discussions and data points from a survey given to the audience. To begin, I met with Dr. Jonathan Friedberg to talk about lymphomas in CLL, and he began by providing a broad overview of current management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia.
So CLL is clearly a disease where I think things are changing very quickly in the upfront management. Historically, we've used chemoimmunotherapy, and that dates back many years when randomized studies suggested that the addition of rituximab to standard chemotherapy improved not only progression-free survival, but overall survival. And therefore, for younger patients, I think based on those previous trials, FCR is considered a standard treatment. Now, that begs two questions. One, what defines the younger patient? And I think FCR clearly, as patients get into their 60s and 70s, is not tolerated well. Toxicity goes up, and in fact, survival benefit goes away with that regimen. So if a patient is 40 or 50, I think FCR is much more desirable than if a patient is above 60 or has other comorbidities. The second issue is we're in an era of more modern, novel targeted treatments. And there's been great enthusiasm to introduce these novel targeted treatments up front. There were randomized studies that have been completed enrollment, but we don't have the readout yet, comparing in younger patients FCR versus ibrutinib and rituximab, and in older patients BR versus ibrutinib alone and ibrutinib and rituximab. The issue with younger patients is the observation has been made that at 8 to 10 years of follow-up, after FCR, a substantial proportion of these patients remain free of disease. And some people are even suggesting that we may be curing a subset of patients with FCR. And for that reason, I think for the younger fit patient, FCR remains the standard until we have more mature data from those randomized trials. However, in older patients, I think toxicity becomes the chief concern. And although BR is a perfectly reasonable regimen for older patients and has been shown to be tolerated reasonably well, in my experience, ibrutinib is tolerated better. And for that reason, for older patients who are less fit or patients with comorbidities, I usually choose an ibrutinib-based treatment for my upfront approach for older patients.
Any comment about this trade-off, though, between indefinite therapy with ibrutinib, whether it's in the older patient? You can bring that same argument up in the younger patient. And also the issue of, you mentioned FCR as having the possibility of launching a patient into unmaintained remission. What about BR or obinutuzumab chlorambucil? Maybe less effective, but you do still have that same phenomenon.
So first issue that you brought up was the issue of continuous therapy versus a rather short course of therapy. And I think we still need to learn as oncologists patient preferences. I think many patients would prefer to get 6 months of therapy and stop versus continuous therapy, depending on what the burden of the continuous therapy is. If somebody has a continuous rash or diarrhea, that is certainly less preferable to simply just some mild bruising and hypertension that could be controlled. So some of it is the nature of what chronic toxicities could be there. The other issue is, will there be late toxicities that emerge, or are we somehow with ibrutinib potentially changing CLL or selecting for resistant clones such that when disease progresses, it may be hard to treat? And we don't know the answer to that yet. And that's why in younger patients, until we have longer follow-up of upfront trials, I'm hesitant to use ibrutinib as a standard.
So we asked a poll question to sort of tease a little bit out how people kind of factor these things in clinically. And it's interesting, we were going to say, what's your usual upfront therapy for a patient with CLL and del17p? And I said, no, let's not ask that. Everybody knows it's ibrutinib. But then we presented the same case, but now the patient has history of atrial fibrillation is on anticoagulation. First of all, interestingly, 22% of the audience said FCR, 11% said BR. So maybe we should have asked The other question, which is without anticoagulation, I'd like you to comment on those answers. And then most of the audience would just go with ibrutinib in spite of the atrial fibrillation and anticoagulation, although a small number, including actually Chris Flowers, the other faculty person, would use venetoclax, which I'm not sure how easy it'd be to actually get it. But what about this issue of the patient who already has anticoagulation? And what about chemotherapy in a patient with del-17P? My understanding is there's really no role for that up front.
Right. So del-17P is not a common occurrence up front. That's an important point to make for the audience. Many patients with CLL will acquire del-17P over the course of their disease. But at upfront diagnosis, and usually in the setting of first therapy, it's rather uncommon. When it occurs, it tends to occur in older patients, and that's an important point as we're thinking about treatment choices. Clearly, I think for the patient who has deletion of 17P, and all patients should be tested for that before a treatment decision is made, chemoimmunotherapy is inadequate. Multiple studies, no matter what the chemoimmunotherapy regimen is, BR, FCR, other versions of chemotherapy combinations have suggested that remission durations, when remission occurs, are too short to justify that. Clearly, with these novel agents, particularly ibrutinib, the outcomes have improved. I should still emphasize the outcomes are inferior to ibrutinib given to patients who don't have deletion of 17P, so it's still a high-risk situation. But it's all relative, and when you compare the experience of ibrutinib as compared with chemoimmunotherapy, I think it's very clear that guidelines and all experts would agree that a novel agent up front is appropriate for these patients. Now, the question is, if somebody has atrial fibrillation, should that affect the choice of ibrutinib? And that's where I think there's been a learning curve over time. First of all, ibrutinib does have the risk of putting patients into atrial fibrillation. And clearly, if somebody's intermittently in and out of atrial fibrillation, they may be at even higher risk of going into atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib. Second issue is that in some of the very early studies with ibrutinib, there was a bleeding risk that was thought to be due to some platelet dysfunction. And the serious bleeds that occurred, including a couple of CNS bleeds, were in patients who were on anticoagulation with warfarin. And for that reason, there's a relative contraindication. However, if you're dealing with a high-risk CLL situation and you can carefully manage anticoagulation, I think our choice would still be to proceed with ibrutinib carefully with such a patient. What we tend to do is to use novel anticoagulation regimens rather than warfarin in these patients, because the control is better. You don't get the spikes that you often see with warfarin as far as the level of anticoagulation. And we have long discussions with the cardiologists and the internists about how important the anticoagulation is for that given patient. Many patients, if there's a relative contraindication, can be taken off anticoagulation. And I have a few patients in my clinic now who have atrial fibrillation, are on anticoagulation, and are being successfully managed with ibrutinib. And thus far, fortunately, the only major thing that we've observed is some increased bruising.
If you could access venetoclax for a patient like that, and I'm not sure that whether you could or not, would you prefer that? What do we know about the indirect comparison, say, between venetoclax and ibrutinib in this situation?
So they have not been compared head-to-head. However, venetoclax has been demonstrated to rescue patients who progress after ibrutinib. And that's usually a good indicator that it's as active or perhaps more active for at least a subset of patients with this high-risk genetic lesion in CLL. We're still learning how to use venetoclax. It's such an active drug that tumor lysis syndrome is often observed. And particularly in the upfront setting where patients walk in the door often with a high burden of disease, a white count that might exceed 100,000 and bulky adenopathy, that's a setup for venetoclax to potentially really cause tumor lysis. I just got back from the Lugano International Lymphoma meetings last week, and one of the plenary talks there was about a regimen that was trying to use venetoclax upfront. And what they did was they gave single agent bendamustine basically to debulk the patient without antibody. They introduced obinutuzumab then And then they followed that with a slow ramp up of venetoclax, and they showed that that was safe. And the plan is to use an MRD-based assessment as far as how long to keep that regimen going. And I think that that type of model may be the way that ultimately we use venetoclax up front, even in these high-risk genetic lesions, rather than just starting venetoclax in a patient with an extremely high tumor burden of disease.
When you think about the way these drugs work, and I mean, bring in, you know, other drugs, adalimumab, for example, which are the drugs that you think might be amenable to use being used short-term, getting MRD and stopping therapy, as opposed to, in your mind, maybe something that you're not likely to ever be able to stop?
I think that's an important question for so many reasons. Toxicity, frankly, financial cost as well. If you're going to start every new patient with CLL on ibrutinib, and they could be on that for between 5 and 10 years, I mean, I think we have a responsibility to society to understand how much of that treatment is really necessary. The direct answer to your question is that many of the studies with venetoclax have been with a more abbreviated course of treatment. And venetoclax has demonstrated, both as a single agent as well as in combinations, the ability to achieve deep remissions and MRD negativity. And I think for that reason, there's a lot of enthusiasm with venetoclax to try to use MRD as a way to modulate the duration of treatment. With ibrutinib, many patients who have excellent responses do not reach MRD negativity. And in fact, I'll just say that I have patients who were treated on the randomized upfront trial of FCR versus ibrutinib and rituximab who are 2 years out, seemingly in a clinical remission, but their bone marrow still has visible CLL. They feel well and their counts are normal. But I think the important message there is that if you stopped the ibrutinib, the disease could come back quickly. So I think for many patients, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to stop ibrutinib based on its mechanism of action.
You talked about the issue of del17p coming on after the diagnosis. What do we know about the frequency that that occurs? And clinically, when do you sort of think about taking another look at a patient?
So the dynamics of CLL are such that, probably similar to follicular lymphoma, although we think of the disease as a clonal disease, there are often multiple clones that are present within a given patient. And probably what happens is that if you have a, say, a deletion 17 clone that is at a very low frequency, with treatment in particular, you may end up selecting for that clone since it's unresponsive to the treatment as compared to some of the more favorable prognosis clones. I'm not aware of vigorous data that tells exactly what the rate is of development of deletion of 17p, although I think in some of the studies of relapsed and refractory disease, up to 30 to 40% of patients who enroll on the trials that are unselected do have that genetic lesion. So it can become quite common. My practice is that if I'm starting a new treatment for CLL, I look and determine what the genetics are at that time. And I think that should be a practice that all providers use because we're at a point now where the choice of treatment is largely dependent upon these genetics. And there is a dynamic nature to them.
So, final question about CLL. We asked the audience, what about patient with del17p? Who gets ibrutinib, responds, but then has disease progression 4 years later. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't unanimous. I thought everybody kind of knew that venetoclax was next. Actually, half the audience picked something else, including adalimumab, which kind of surprised me. But anyhow, can you talk about second-line therapy with del17p?
Sure. I mean, venetoclax is approved for that indication. Idelalisib does have some activity, and before venetoclax was approved, I think that there would be a reasonable nature to that answer. But I think at this point, venetoclax is so much more active that unless there was a major concern about tumor lysis or toxicity, or it wasn't available for some reason, the standard approach and what guidelines would recommend, I think uniformly, would be venetoclax in such a situation.
We've talked before about the issue of venetoclax and tumor lysis syndrome that you were referring to. And I'm curious now that more time has gone on, any other clinical experience with it? I remember I asked you in the past how often you were putting people in the hospital, how long they were going on. Now that it's kind of out there a little bit, any further reflections on it?
I think venetoclax has been studied not just in CLL, but in lymphomas as well. And I think what's been observed is that there may be some differences between diseases on the rate of tumor lysis. So although there's obviously a conservatism because this is something you don't want to miss, it did result in death in some of the very early trials. The risk of tumor lysis is clearly higher in bulky CLL as compared with some of the lymphomas that venetoclax may be used for. I think that the label provides reasonable guidance on a management strategy for tumor lysis. And what it does really is differentiate between what they call laboratory tumor lysis and clinical tumor lysis. And I think that obviously the frequency of lab draws could be modified to some degree from what the label suggests. But the issue is that the goal is to try to intervene like you would in any tumor lysis situation before the creatinine starts to go up and before the patient starts to exhibit real symptoms. So watching things like uric acid and other electrolytes frequently as you're ramping up this drug is important.
All right, so let's move on to talk about FL. And of course, the big poll question we wanted to ask the audience was, I guess now 6 months after ASH, and having seen the gallium study looking at obinutuzumab up front, we were curious about where people were with that. So we asked the audience, and what we saw, that the audience is still in the R-bendamustine camp, but there were a fair number of people using obinutuzumab, including your co-faculty person, Dr. Flowers, although you said you're sticking with R-bendamustine. So can you talk a little bit about, we also asked the audience what they thought about the data in the gallium study and whether they thought there was enough evidence to support using obinutuzumab. 20% said yes, 34% said yes, but they want to see the paper. And then the rest were not really, generally not sure about it. So I'm curious, and now it's been 6 months, you've had plenty of time to talk about it with your colleagues. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the gallium findings. And what do you think it means right now in terms of practice? Also, do you know, is there going to be a paper coming out?
There's definitely going to be a paper coming out. And I spoke to the lead investigator, Dr. Marcus, suggesting that that paper is going to be coming out in a very prominent journal, almost certainly quite soon.
Great.
So we'll start by just outlining the gallium trial. And I'll emphasize that this was a very robust trial. It enrolled well over 1,000 patients with follicular lymphoma. And this study randomized patients to either R chemotherapy versus obinutuzumab chemotherapy. And sites could choose which chemotherapy regimen they would give. And the three chemotherapy choices were CVP, CHOP, and bendamustine. The majority of the sites did choose bendamustine, although there was a fairly significant representation of CHOP-based treatment as well. The primary endpoint of this was progression-free survival, and the treatment was 6 cycles of treatment, and then there was a maintenance of either rituximab or obinutuzumab, depending on which arm you were randomized to, that went on for 2 years. It's similar to the PRIMA trial. And the primary endpoint was met. There was a statistically significant benefit of progression-free survival in patients who were treated with obinutuzumab and chemotherapy as compared to rituximab and chemotherapy. Sub-analyses have been conducted and presented, and they demonstrated that with all three chemotherapy regimens, there was a benefit with obinutuzumab as compared to rituximab. The benefit was most prevalent with patients treated with CVP and obinutuzumab, but it was clearly there for CHOP and bendamustine as well. There was an MRD analysis that suggested that maybe an explanation as to why patients with obinutuzumab had better progression-free survival was that there was a higher rate of MRD obtainment with the three chemotherapy regimens. Interestingly, bendamustine had the highest rate of MRD on that trial, whether the patients got rituximab or obinutuzumab. Another facet of this trial that has gotten a lot of discussion was a relatively small but significant number of deaths were observed during the maintenance phase of the treatment that seemed disproportionate to patients who had had bendamustine induction as compared to the other regimens. The causes of these deaths were multifactorial. There was no one signal of a certain type of infection, but there were enough deaths that the rate of toxic death on the trial was on the order of 4 or 5% of patients treated with bendamustine as compared to, say, 2% on the other arms. And there was some question as to why that would be. And I think in the end, people have concluded that it's clearly the case that if progression-free survival is the most important endpoint, that the obinutuzumab antibody does lengthen progression-free survival as compared to rituximab in the setting of maintenance treatment and induction chemoimmunotherapy. And some people have concluded that CHOP may provide a lower death rate in the short term as compared with bendamustine, although there's other data sets that have been presented, long-term follow-up of both the STILL trial and the BRIGHT trial at ASCO, that do not show these death rates that were associated with bendamustine. So with all of that, the question is, you know, what are we doing now? And I would say that if progression-free survival is the most important goal for a provider and their patient, then you have to take this study seriously. The data is clearly robust. It's one of the largest randomized trials ever conducted in this disease. And there's a statistically significant benefit in progression-free survival with obinutuzumab. In my mind, though, I don't place the only premium on progression-free survival in this disease. As evidence of that, I don't routinely give maintenance. There's never been an overall survival benefit to maintenance. And I should emphasize that there's certainly no hint of an overall survival difference in the gallium trial between any of the arms. So I think that there is an increased toxicity seen with obinutuzumab. It's modest, but there's more infusion toxicity and a little more neutropenia and infection. And I think it's a balancing act. And I would say that a few lessons from this trial to me are that it's one of the first trials that really does study maintenance after bendamustine-based treatment. And I think that this trial, one might conclude that that might not be such a good idea. And if you're using bendamustine, therefore, I think that the combination of bendamustine and rituximab or the combination of bendamustine and obinutuzumab are both reasonable options. I'm still using bendamustine and rituximab in my clinic, but I think that it's possible over time there may be a change. I'm still studying some of the details of the data.
So one other issue in FL, which is recurrent disease, and we presented a patient who presented age 60, gets BR with maintenance, and then has a relapse 3 years later. And the audience was split between retreatment with BR, R-CHOP, and R-squared. I want you to comment on the way you approach recurrent after bendamustine rituximab and how the time to recurrence affects your decision. Where do things stand in terms of PI3 kinase inhibitors in those diseases? Right now we have adalimumab. There are other agents being tested, capanlisib. Do you think this is a viable treatment strategy moving forward, and how do you think it's going to develop?
So, I mean, PI3 kinase is obviously an important pathway in lymphomas as well as in many tumors. Idelalisib was the first approved for lymphomas and CLL, PI3 kinase delta specific inhibitor. And it's clearly a very active drug. I continue to use it. It's available. It's approved. The issue with idelalisib is that post-approval, in a number of clinical trials that were attempting to move it to the upfront setting, there appeared to be an increased risk of toxic deaths. And these included deaths that seemed to be secondary to some immunosuppression. For example, pneumocystis infections and CMV reactivations were observed. And as well as the other known side effects like colitis and transaminase elevations, I think the enthusiasm for the drug has gone down, particularly when you contrast it with a drug like ibrutinib, where this toxicity is less. That doesn't take away the importance of the target. And of course, there are a number of companies that are looking at other drugs that may fit in this space. You mentioned capanlisib. This was another abstract that was presented at the recent Lugano meeting that looked at capanlisib in relapsed refractory B-cell lymphomas. A lot of them were patients with follicular lymphoma. Actually, the outcomes looked fairly similar to what you'd expect with idelalisib. Capanlisib is intravenous, which makes it a little less convenient for the patient, particularly if there's a prolonged duration of treatment. It's also an alpha-delta inhibitor, And the alpha inhibition seems to have other toxicities, including hypertension and hyperglycemia, all of which can be controlled, but it's just something to be aware of. There are a number of other PI3 kinase inhibitors. I mentioned TGR-1202, which is a delta-specific inhibitor that, at least in the initial reports, seems to have less transaminase elevation, less pneumonitis than what was seen with idelalisib. So I think we're going to see new agents available in this space. To what degree they end up becoming a major part of the therapeutic armamentarium, I think are going to depend critically on two things. One is, are we able to choose patients who are most likely to respond? And the second is, can the toxicities be managed in such a way that they're tolerated better than what we saw with idelalisib?
What do we know right now in terms of toxicities tolerability with capanalisib compared to idelalisib?
So, of course, no head-to-head comparisons. What was seen in the presentation was much less transaminase elevation. There was a signal on lung infection and pneumonitis that was reported. The rate of pneumonitis was low, but not zero, so it suggests that it's there. And as I said, the other events that were seen were some nausea, some hyperglycemia, and hypertension. So the profile does look somewhat different. They did not have any CMV reactivations or pneumocystis opportunistic type infections that I can recall from the presentation. The slides tend to move pretty quickly. So I think there's a signal that capanalisib may be tolerated somewhat better, or at least have a different profile of toxicity as compared to what was seen with idelalisib.
So final question. When we were talking before about ibrutinib and all the difficulties, or some of the difficulties that do occur sometimes, I was wanting to ask you, what about other BTK inhibitors? There's one, acalabrutinib, had a big New England Journal paper. What's the likelihood that they might be more effective, or maybe more likely that maybe they might not be as toxic or have bleeding or some of these other problems?
So acalabrutinib is a, I'll call it like a designer drug, a perfect example of a second generation drug that was designed specifically to be more specific for BTK. Not surprisingly, ibrutinib, in addition to hitting BTK, hits a few other things. And it's probably the other things that are more responsible for some of the toxicities, including bleeding and atrial fibrillation. So the goal of acalabrutinib is really to decrease toxicity, although the argument could be made by being a more pure inhibitor of BTK, maybe efficacy would be higher. It was a randomized trial that was accrued, and we don't know the answer yet, to try to compare ibrutinib with acalabrutinib. The main endpoint there is toxicity. I think the key question is ibrutinib toxic enough to really need a replacement? As much as these are real issues for people, overall, this is a very well-tolerated drug. And of all the treatments that I give, I find ibrutinib to be among the easiest. It may turn out to be a scenario over time, like the TKIs and CML, where, you know, we had a great drug, imatinib, but there were issues with it, and second and third generation drugs came out, and many of the patients ended up on those drugs because of at least a signal of maybe improved efficacy and a different toxicity profile. So we'll have to see. But in my opinion, anything that happens with like acalabrutinib or some of the other drugs, these are going to be only minimal incremental advances. I think ibrutinib is giving us most of what we're going to see by targeting BTK.
So let's move on and talk about a couple of things we asked for practical purposes about mantle cell lymphoma. One, we've seen data coming out over the last few years, including fairly recently, looking at the issue of maintenance. You talked about your thoughts about maintenance before with CLL and FL. This is in mantle cell. So we asked the audience both about patients who've undergone transplant and older patients who haven't. And it looks like most people are using maintenance for 2 years in both situations. How do you approach it?
There's interesting data regarding maintenance in mantle cell lymphoma. After autologous transplant, there was a study that had a specific induction regimen, a specific transplant regimen, and they then gave rituximab maintenance, and actually suggested an overall survival benefit to rituximab maintenance. And I think for patients who undergo the aggressive autologous transplant, it's reasonable to strongly consider maintenance for that reason. If there's the potential for an overall survival benefit, and these are patients who have been selected for an aggressive treatment course, it's appropriate to consider that. In the older patient population, the enthusiasm for maintenance is really based on a German trial that suggested after CHOP-based therapy, there was a benefit to rituximab maintenance as compared to interferon. Clearly, we don't use interferon. There wasn't a signal that interferon caused deaths. So the conclusion was that the rituximab maintenance clearly added potentially a survival benefit. What was important to note is that in that trial, there was another induction regimen that was fludarabine-based, and there was no benefit to the maintenance in the patients who were treated with the fludarabine induction. And similarly, there has been a randomized trial of maintenance versus no maintenance after BR in upfront treatment of mantle cell lymphoma, and there didn't appear to be any benefit to maintenance if bendamustine was used as induction. Since I tend to favor bendamustine-based induction for older patients with mantle cell lymphoma, I'm not generally using maintenance in that situation.
And it's interesting, again, your faculty co-leader, Dr. Flowers, gave the exact opposite answers of you. He doesn't use it in the transplant situation and uses it in older patients, so I guess people see the data differently. One other question we asked about, which was the audience awareness of venetoclax in mantle cell. You were referring to that earlier, and actually we're hearing about venetoclax in myeloma, where we're not hearing about tumor lysis, incidentally. But about a third of the audience was not aware that venetoclax really has activity in mantle cell. What do we know about this? And right now, are there situations where you're attempting to or able to access venetoclax in mantle cell?
So the studies still are relatively small, and the initial venetoclax manuscript was actually just recently published in JCO that looked at a variety of tumor types, all different types of lymphomas, not tumor types, but subsets of lymphomas. And they then looked specifically by type, follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, and so forth. And there was a strong signal that for the relatively small number of patients with mantle cell lymphoma who had been treated, that the response rate was very high. And for that reason, I think multiple investigators have tried venetoclax on occasion if they have a patient with mantle cell lymphoma, say, that's refractory to both ibrutinib and lenalidomide, and you really are running out of options. We have a CAR-T trial open for patients who are ibrutinib resistant. And one of the things that we've tried in those patients who tend to have very aggressive disease when you're ibrutinib resistant with mantle cell lymphoma, we've used in a couple of situations venetoclax as a bridge to try to then consolidate the patient with something like CAR-T or allogeneic stem cell transplantation. And I've seen that used by some colleagues in New York City. And in a couple of anecdotal cases, it's been quite successful. So I think for this patient with stubborn mantle cell lymphoma, where you've completely run out of other options, given the commercial availability of venetoclax, it's definitely something that should be considered.
So I'm kind of curious, which CAR-T platform are you testing?
The anti-CD19 CAR-T, one of their Zuma trials that's currently open and accruing patients, is looking for ibrutinib refractory mantle cell lymphoma. So it's pretty restrictive in that you have to have a certain induction regimen that's considered standard, relapse, then get ibrutinib, progress through ibrutinib, and then they're candidates for the CAR-T platform. The results are really not available for that study yet. Interestingly, it's been a national trial, and it's accruing much slower than many of the other CAR-T trials, in part because I think with mantle cell lymphoma, many of the patients who are on ibrutinib have only been on it for a couple of years, and it's around the time that you'd expect some of those patients to start progressing. So it'll be an interesting trial for that subset of mantle cell lymphoma patients who are young enough to tolerate it.
Yeah, that anti-CD19 agent, I think it now has a name, AxiCell.
Yes.
We actually were working the other day with Fred Locke, who's the PI, I think, on the Zuma study. And then we had David Porter also here talking about it. I wanted to, maybe now's a good time to just, because my brain is still full of CAR-T, but it was really an amazing day. And I'm curious what you know about the data, what you think about them. I was shocked. I mean, they have a lot of CRs. I mean, there are a lot of, I know there's issues with the cytokine release syndrome, the neurologic problems. They all sound scary, but this may be approved in diffuse large B-cell like soon.
Correct. And it's timely that you ask this. Again, at the Lugano meeting that just occurred last week, there were three abstracts, including two that were near the plenary session, reviewing the updated data from both the Zuma trial as well as the Juliet trial. And the bottom line is, I've had personal experience, and our institution has been participating in the Zuma trial. So I have patients of my own who have gone through this treatment. It, I think, has the potential to be transformative therapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that's refractory to standard treatment. The agents, we still have a lot to learn. You mentioned toxicity. I think that patients really need to be fit enough for an allogeneic stem cell transplant to consider this treatment. There's a mortality associated with the treatment, and the morbidity, including neurologic toxicity, and as you mentioned, the transient but sometimes severe cytokine release syndrome, does require many of these patients to end up in the intensive care unit for a short period of time. That being said, unlike allogeneic transplant, when you get discharged from the hospital, you're done with treatment. And I have seen absolutely refractory patients have durable remissions from this treatment. I have a patient with primary mediastinal disease that was so aggressive it was growing through palliative radiation. Those are patients that generally have only weeks to live. She was treated with this treatment, and she's now about 10 months out and still in a complete remission. Both agents have similar results. It's a little hard to compare head-to-head because the time that it takes from patient signing up until the time that they get the drug is somewhat different between the two products.
So just a couple of quick questions about diffuse large B-cell. I wanted to ask you though about that CAR-T, but a couple of things we talked about in the meeting. One, we always ask this, and we always see the same thing. I think I mentioned that about the use of lenalidomide in relapsed diffuse large B-cell. As usual, the faculty, Drs. Ansel and Fanal, said they use it in the relapse setting. And as usual, 40% of the audience says they don't, which we always see. Is lenalidomide a part of your armamentarium for relapsed diffuse large B-cell?
Absolutely. I think studies have suggested, including randomized trials now, that for patients who are ineligible for transplant, where you're just trying to palliate the patient, that lenalidomide is probably as good as standard single-agent chemotherapy. And I think it's tolerated much better. The other interesting thing about lenalidomide is a relatively small subset of patients do have a very long progression-free survival with lenalidomide. And for that reason, it's actually my go-to regimen outside of a clinical trial for patients who are transplant ineligible and have relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
So another question we asked about diffuse large B-cell was, do you do CD30 testing and will you administer bevacizumab? The audience is very split about those questions. How about you?
We routinely do it, but in part we're doing it because in older patients, the elderly population, we have a trial open that is looking at brentuximab substituted for vincristine in the mini R-CHOP regimen for elderly patients. The rationale for that is that elderly patients are enriched for CD30 positivity. There's more EBV-associated disease in elderly patients, and brentuximab is tolerated reasonably well in that group. My colleagues have, in the relapse setting, tested for CD30, and I think if a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is robustly CD30 positive, I certainly would consider brentuximab as an option in that situation. It's very reasonable to test.
Have you seen objective responses to bevacizumab with diffuse large B-cell?
I have, but they've been very transient in nature, and how durable they are, I think, really remains to be seen. There are some interesting trials that are open. We're participating in a multi-center study that's combining brentuximab with a checkpoint inhibitor for patients with CD30 positive disease. And there's rationale, particularly in the microenvironment, to potentially do that. I think that over time, we may learn a strategy that could include brentuximab for these patients. But I think you have to be cognizant that the true meaningful response rate of meaningful duration for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in this agent is likely to be short and low.
So we asked the audience a couple questions about Hodgkin lymphoma, and always interesting to try to tease out this issue related to Hodgkin lymphoma is the issue of post-transplant consolidation with bevacizumab for relapsed disease. Of course, we saw the ATHEA trial come out a couple years ago looking at bevacizumab. So we presented two scenarios. One, a patient who has recurrent disease 2 years after initial treatment with ABVD, has ice, goes to transplant, has a CR. Only involvement in the relapse is nodes. So nodal relapse 2 years later. And there we saw that actually quite a few people in the audience, more than half, would use bevacizumab consolidation. All our two faculty members would not. And then we changed the case to be a relapse 10 months later with a relapse in the nodes and the liver. And the numbers for everybody go up, and now the faculty would use consolidation also for a year. How do you approach this issue? You know, you got into this thing about another one of these progression review survival dilemmas, huh?
Well, I think it's different in Hodgkin lymphoma because, first of all, the disease can be symptomatic. And second of all, the goal here is clearly cure. And I would say that we don't know 100% yet that this progression-free survival benefit is actually curing more patients. But it seems to be durable up to about 3 years. And to me, that's a sign that we may be curing a subset of patients by giving the maintenance brentuximab after autologous transplant. My approach sounds like similar to the other faculty, is to really base my selection for patients for this approach upon the trial entry criteria, which were if you had a high-risk relapse with Hodgkin lymphoma, either early relapse after ABVD or a relapse that included extranodal disease, those patients were eligible for the randomization of brentuximab versus not brentuximab, and they were the ones who benefited. We don't know necessarily in low-risk relapse if there would be a benefit or not. In most of those patients, I would not myself do that. I will say the majority of the relapses today are in the high-risk category, though. And that's therefore most of our patients that we see in our transplant program are getting brentuximab maintenance. I think that brentuximab maintenance, particularly for these young patients where you're trying to cure, you should try to push to get the patients to get it. Although I will say that I've had a number of patients who have started that and have not been able to finish the 1 year of maintenance due to neuropathy and other toxicities. And although in the clinical trial, the median number of cycles given, I think, was 15, most patients got most of the treatments. I've had a number of patients since the trial who have decided themselves to stop early. So I think it does require informing the patient what the benefit is. And at least to date, it appears that there may be a 10 to 15% benefit in progression-free survival, which if it's durable, ultimately will probably indicate an overall survival benefit.